This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربكم ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Saudi Arabia intensifies its airstrikes on the Yemeni capital Sana'a, hitting a stadium and an area near a hospital in its latest attacks. Iran's top diplomat slams as unconstructive the stance of European countries in the recent Vienna talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal.
We did not see the position of some European countries as very constructive, specifically that of France.
And South Korea grants a special pardon, that is, to former President Park Geun-hye, who was serving a jail term of 22 years for corruption. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: Saudi warplanes once again pound the Yemeni capital Sana'a as the kingdom intensifies its airstrikes on the country. Saudi jets bombed a number of residential areas. One of the attacks hit a venue near a hospital, leaving at least one civilian injured. Yemen's Ansar Allah movement has rejected Riyadh's claim that the site was a weapons depot. Saudi fighter jets also hit a sports complex in northern Sana'a. In reaction, Yemen's Olympic Committee called on international bodies to put an end to Saudi attacks against sports facilities. Riyadh has recently stepped up its aggression on Yemen. The Saudi war on the country began in 2015 and has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead. Political activist Faraz al-Najm says Saudi Arabia's Western allies are perpetuating the war on Yemen to achieve their regional goals.
It's more of a geopolitical kind of issue. It's because they want to control Bab al-Mandab, because you have two main water passages into the Middle East, and this supports the U.S. bases and their control and their puppet regimes, such as the Saudi regime and the Bahraini regime and so on. And also, it's to support the Zionist regime at most. So, you have Hormuz is one area, and that's already, they know that it's in the control of the Iranians and the Iranian forces and the government, and that could be at any time choked. And then the other one is Bab al-Mandab. This is the one that's in Yemen, right on the borders. So they don't want to lose that one. If they lose both of them, then choked, and there's a way to liberate Palestine. So this is the main issue, you know what I mean? It's all about this control of the whole region.
Iran's foreign minister says his country will in a serious manner continue talks with the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Hossein Amir Abdullahian, at the same time, has criticized the European parties for taking an unconstructive approach in the talks.
The other parties are continuously doing interviews, saying that they are worried about the progress of Iran's nuclear program. We announce it loudly that if you want to alleviate your concerns about Iran's peaceful nuclear program, all JCPOA-related sanctions against Iran must be removed. The Islamic Republic of Iran will continue its strong talks in a logical manner until a good deal is reached. On the whole, we did not see the position of some European countries as very constructive, specifically that of France. In the latest round of talks, the three European countries practically presented no new initiatives.
Amir Abdullahian also said Iran rejects this approach, that the other parties offer one concession to get several ones in return. Tehran and the remaining JCPOA members have held 7 rounds of talks in Vienna this year to resolve outstanding issues over the 2015 deal. Those issues began after the US unilaterally pulled out of the accord in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. In response, Tehran rolled back its commitments a year later. Iran says it will fully meet its obligations only after the US removes the sanctions. Vienna will host a new round of negotiations by the JCPOA members next week. International lawyer and peace activist John Philpott says the US must pay reparations to Iran for violating the 2015 deal.
I noticed Britain saying time's running out for Iran. Well, is it not the US who's in the wrong? Iran is not in the wrong. Iran maintained its commitments for quite a while, I don't know the number of months, but a year or two after they allowed inspections and did not start to enrich uranium. I don't know a lot about uranium other than what I read, but they respected the agreement even though they didn't have to, because U.S. withdrawing, they're no longer bound. Now, Iran is trying to resolve this sanctions issue. I'm a member of Sanctions Kill. Sanctions do kill, and sanctions are illegal in international law. I think the U.S. has to pay reparations, personally. I'm not in power, but U.S. should be paying reparations to Iran for these illegal sanctions.
Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi tells the Iraqi foreign minister that a principal policy of Iran is to support the stability and sovereignty of Iraq. Raisi was speaking with Fuad Hussein here in Tehran. President Raisi said Iran views insecurity in neighboring Iraq as insecurity on Iranian soil. He also hailed the resistance of the Iraqi people and said it's the main reason making American forces leave the Arab country. Iran's president said once the U.S. enters a country, it does not leave unless it faces popular resistance. Political commentator Sayed Mohsen Abbas says steps to boost bilateral relations between Iran and Iraq are very crucial for the region.
I think it's a very, as ever, significant move. Of course, the relations between Iraq and Iran are very cordial. They're very essential. Not only does Iran supply Iraq most of its electricity, it also has a huge trade of in excess of $15 to $18 billion per annum, which is a massive boost or shot in the arm of an Iraq which is beleaguered by the successive invasions of the Americans themselves. And now what we're seeing is that finally there's some element of scaling down of the U.S. footprint. And I think the Iraqis are well on the way. The only chance that the Americans and the Zionists stand is if there's disunity within Iraq. And they've been trying to stoke that by funding this kind of, if you like, sectarian politics, the Kurds, whipping up the Kurds. They've virtually made the northern Kurdish areas a depot for themselves as a long-term way of destabilizing the region. These are the challenges that the Iraqi people face.
Senior Iranian military commander says the ground force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps is displaying its latest accomplishments during the large-scale war games that are underway in the south of the country.
The drills featured massive artillery fire as well as operations by the Amphibious Operations Unit of the IRGC Ground Force. As you saw today, the exercises involved divers as well as large numbers of vessels taking combat troops to the shore, which was among the most important achievements of the IRGC Ground Force. This has enabled the force to couple its defense operations with combat tactics.
The IRGC forces wrapped up the ground phase by conducting extensive drills overnight. They rehearsed a combination of tactics using artillery and armored units, attack helicopters, and drones. The maneuvers have been ongoing in the Persian Gulf region, the Strait of Hormuz, as well as the coasts of Hormuzgan, Bushehr, and Khuzestan provinces. The exercises, codenamed the Great Prophet 17, are part of military drills Iran holds regularly to improve its combat power. The five-day maneuvers will end on Friday. The United States has used the language of threat against Iran once again, a familiar and outdated phrase called other options, used interchangeably with all options. But many analysts argue that a look at Iran's massive military exercises involving new weaponry, equipment, and modern techniques should make the U.S. think twice before making a military threat.
The United States has stepped up its anti-Iran rhetoric, threatening Iran with, quote, other options if negotiations in the Austrian capital fail to restore the 2015 agreements. The threatening language was made by the U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley. He warned of a period of escalating crisis if diplomacy failed to restore the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. The remarks came days after negotiators from Iran and the remaining parties to the JCPOA concluded the seventh round of talks in Vienna, aimed at bringing the U.S. back into compliance with the agreement by removing its sanctions against Iran. Malley referred to Iran's retaliatory measures within the JCPOA framework and said, if they continue at their current pace, we have some weeks left to restore the 2015 deal, but not much more than that, at which point the conclusion will be that there is no deal to be revived. Meanwhile, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said the window is rapidly closing to save the 2015 agreement and that Washington is exploring other options.
U.S. government is very much aware of this fact that the U.S. Army, the broad masses of Americans, don't want another war. We have just gotten out of Afghanistan after 20 years. Finally, things are perhaps coming to a close in Iraq as well. And so to, you know, within under a year, go back into Eurasia, go back into also the Arab world and start another war would be absolutely disastrous.
Blinken claimed Iran's nuclear advances are making it increasingly problematic to return to the 2015 agreement. It is getting very, very, very short. Being able to recover the full benefits of the JCPOA by returning to compliance with it is getting increasingly problematic by the advances that Iran makes every single day in its nuclear program. This is while the Vienna talks have taken a break after Iran and the IAEA reached an agreement for the agency to install its cameras at the Karaj nuclear facility, a point insisted by the parties to the talk. Iran also agreed to this as a goodwill gesture. Antony Blinken also blamed the former administration of Donald Trump for the worst decision made in American foreign policy in the last decade by withdrawing from the deal in 2018.
The U.S. military threats against Iran pale next to the number of times Israel has threatened Iran militarily. Not only has Israel been a loud opponent of the Vienna talks aimed at the removal of sanctions, it has even said that it would attack Iran and target its nuclear facilities with or without an agreement. But many observers believe such an attack can only take place with a green light from the United States.
The threatening language against Iran comes amid ongoing talks to revive the deal, which was abandoned by the United States in 2018 under the administration of the former President Donald Trump. Israel has opposed efforts to revive the 2015 deal, which lifted sanctions on Tehran in exchange for curbs on its nuclear program, and has continued to threaten direct military action against Iranian nuclear facilities.
We've seen historically with U.S. presidents, U.S. administrations, that when approval ratings are very, very low, it's common for a president to start a war and attempt to secure a second term. And so Biden, who is experiencing record low approval ratings, may be seeing that as his only option for re-election.
There are some reports that Israel may be preparing for an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities, but former Israeli officials have admitted that Tel Aviv regime is not capable of taking out Iran's nuclear program. Israeli military officials have also cast doubt on the Israeli military's capabilities to destroy all of Iran's nuclear facilities.
So if Israel wanted to take on Iran, because Israel most certainly couldn't do it on its own for a variety of reasons, I think the most significant being Iran would, you know, for lack of better terminology, Iran would wipe the floor with Israel and with the IDF. They would need U.S. support. And Israel can basically yank the chain of the U.S. government and the international media apparatuses and say, you know, we want war, we want the propaganda coming out. And the U.S. and the U.S. media, and the global financial institutions are going to do whatever Israel says.
Iran has warned Israel against any wrong move. The top IRGC official has said any aggression by Israel against Iran would not be possible without the U.S. giving its approval. If such threats are implemented, the Islamic Republic's armed forces will mount thrashing attacks against all centers, bases, paths, and spaces used to enable the violation and against the origins of the violation. Iran has held massive drills in the southern provinces to increase its preparation for any scenario. In the exercises, the IRGC forces showcase their latest capabilities and military hardware, including an advanced homegrown tank dubbed Karar.
Turning elsewhere, South Korea's president grants a pardon to his predecessor, who is serving a lengthy prison term for corruption.
As of December 31st, 2021, the government will grant a special pardon to a total of 3,094 people. We have included former President Park Geun-hye and former Prime Minister Han Myeon-suk to the list to overcome unfortunate past history and the crisis of COVID-19, realize people's unity, and provide a chance to take a new step forward to the future.
The amnesty cuts short a jail term of more than 20 years for the ex-president. Incumbent President Moon Jae-in had previously ruled out a pardon. Moon, however, says the worsening health of his predecessor was a factor in the U-turn. Former President Park Geun-hye has been hospitalized several times this year and is currently receiving treatment. She was arrested in 2017 after being removed from office following a corruption scandal. 1 year later, the 69-year-old was convicted of abuse of power and bribery. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
On Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due.
and he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepest me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden and Senator Joe Manchin, a West Virginia Democrat, have many differences over the proposed domestic policy bill. But one issue stands out: the child tax credit. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Emily Cochrane and Lisa Friedman. The piece is titled "The Policy Debate at the Heart of the Biden-Manchin Standoff." Amid the swell of recrimination and second-guessing that followed the announcement by Senator Joe Manchin that he would not support President Biden's signature domestic policy plan, one point of contention stood out: their differences over an expansion of the child tax credit. The legislation would extend a program under which most families have been receiving monthly payments of up to $300 per child. The program had long been seen by most Democrats as a cornerstone of their social welfare plan, hoisting millions of American children out of poverty while also giving new support to the middle class. And they had hoped to make it a central plank of their midterm campaigns, evidence that Democrats could deliver real help to struggling families. But in opposing the sprawling climate, social spending and tax bill as written, Senator Manchin, a West Virginia Democrat, has been clear about his deep qualms with the cost and structure of the current credit, vacillating between rejecting an extension outright or demanding new limits, such as work requirements for parents. "We have one chance at this, okay?" Mr. Manchin said on Monday in an interview with a West Virginia broadcaster. When asked about his rationale for opposing a package that could benefit his own state, mentioning the child tax credit, he added that he preferred to make sure that people get it that need to get it. Without passage of any legislation before the end of the year, families will have received their last payment under the current plan on 15th of December, losing a stream of money that has helped parents cobble together healthier meals, facilitate car repairs, and cover utility bills. It could be particularly devastating for families in Mr. Manchin's home state of West Virginia, where an estimated 50,000 children could slip deeper into poverty. Having this be a cash benefit that can go to food if it's needed, or clothing if it's needed, or build savings. That flexibility is really important, said Kelly Allen, the executive director of the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy. Families know what they need. Resolving the differences between the administration and Senator Joe Manchin over the proposal, all while retaining the support of nearly every congressional Democrat, Republicans are opposed, will be crucial for party leaders as they seek to revive the package next month when Congress is scheduled to return from its winter recess. President Biden pressed on Tuesday, 21st of December, about whether a deal could be salvaged, sought to downplay his administration's frustrations and differences with Senator Manchin, and insisted that he believed there remained a chance for the package, known as the Build Back Better Act, to become law. He named the child tax credit as a crucial element that would help parents across the country. Senator Manchin and I are going to get something done, he concluded. Mr. Manchin joined Senate Democrats as they convened a rare evening caucus call on Tuesday, 21st of December, to discuss their path forward, according to two officials familiar with the discussion, as both the domestic policy package and voting rights legislation remained in limbo. On the call, which lasted 90 minutes, Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, the majority leader in the Senate, told Democrats that he planned to press forward with votes next year, saying, "We won't stop working on it until we pass a bill," according to one official. Congress expanded the scope of the child tax credit through the end of the year as part of the $1.9 trillion pandemic relief law, which cleared Congress with just Democratic votes, including Mr. Manchin's. Democrats hope to extend it and ultimately make it permanent. The credit, first established in the late 1990s, was increased to cover more families and restructured to allow direct monthly payments this year of up to $250 a child, or $300 for a child under the age of six. It also became fully refundable, meaning families did not need to provide proof of income or owe federal income tax to receive the payment. Of America's 74 million children, nearly 9 in 10 qualified, and the expanded eligibility for families at the low end of the income scale significantly reduced child poverty. In an October Census Bureau report that tracked how about 300,000 recipients spent their first three payments this summer, researchers found that about half of families spent part of the money on food. Other families said they used the money to help pay their rent or their mortgage or utilities, childcare, and school expenses. Under the version of the domestic policy bill passed by the House, the program would be extended by another year. Without an extension of the expanded program, the size of the credit will fall substantially, especially for low-income families. And it will revert to being paid in a once-a-year lump sum connected to filing a tax return rather than half of it distributed monthly. As Democrats hailed the payments hitting their constituents' bank accounts this year, Senator Manchin balked at the cost of the one-year extension, arguing that it was misleading, given that there were ambitions to make it permanent, a step that would cost about an additional $1.5 trillion over a decade, according to the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO. At one point, Senator Manchin also privately voiced concerns to his colleagues that the payments could help fuel opioid use, comments that were first reported by the Wall Street Journal and confirmed by a person familiar with the discussion. Other Democrats and supporters of the proposal have rejected that concern and argued that steps suggested by Senator Manchin, such as imposing work requirements and additional limits on who could receive the money, would make it harder for the neediest families to receive the full benefit. On Tuesday, 21st of December, Senator Manchin went to the White House and put forward his own outline for a domestic policy plan, which included money for universal pre-kindergarten, childcare, and some environmental provisions, but did not include the one-year extension of the child tax credit, according to people familiar with the offer. In the local interview on Monday, Senator Manchin reiterated his concern with the scope of the plan, adding that his preference was to make sure that people are working. If it's called a tax credit, you've got to have a W-2. Supporters of the plan in his home state of West Virginia said his position was at odds with the needs of many of his constituents. "I don't think there's a way to really explain what it means to feel like you're finally getting your head above water and then have that yanked out from underneath you," said Amy Jo Hutchinson, a West Virginia organizer who has been working with advocacy groups to lobby Senator Manchin to support the package. "People were really starting to breathe a little easier." It remains unclear whether President Biden and other Democrats in Congress would give in to Senator Manchin and curtail or remove the tax credit after months of vowing to make it permanent. Without Senator Manchin's support, Democrats have little chance of passing the broader legislation or pushing the child tax credit extension as a standalone bill, since there is little indication that Republicans would support it as written. Pressed on whether her caucus would accept scaling back the credit or imposing work requirements, Representative Pramila Jayapal of Washington, the chairwoman of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, declined to answer, telling reporters on Monday. She said, "I'm not going to negotiate with Joe Manchin on something that I don't even know he wants to do." Mr. Manchin's refusal to take up the plan is drawing pushback beyond progressives, including from the country's largest coal miners' union, which called on the senator to reconsider. "We urge Senator Manchin to revisit his opposition to this legislation and work with his colleagues to pass something that will help keep coal miners working and have a meaningful impact on our members, their families and their communities," Cecil Roberts, the president of the United Mine Workers of America, said in a statement. The version passed by the House included tax incentives that encourage manufacturers to build facilities in coal fields. It also extended an excise tax that is the only source of revenue for a trust fund that pays benefits to coal miners with black lung disease, as well as their survivors when the employer is unable to provide the benefits. Senator Manchin has always been a strong advocate for the United Mine Workers of America and led legislation to address the black lung excise tax expiration, said Sam Runyon, a spokeswoman for Mr. Manchin. Sam Runyon added, "He will of course continue to work to shore up the black lung excise tax in the new year to address the needs of our brave miners."
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream.
Lebanon has always been a platform for freedom of expression and has always been a haven for the tormented, the oppressed, and the exiled. As soon as Lebanon is mentioned, its name is associated with all public liberties. Accordingly, Bahraini opposition activists found in Lebanon a few years ago a safe country for them after they had grown fed up with the practices of the Al-Khalifa regime, which is far away from humanity as can be. Bahraini activists sought refuge in a country full of human rights organizations and exercised their legitimate right to express their human rights cause. Back in their homeland, there are victims and prisoners of conscience who taste all kinds of regime torture without guilt or crime. Back in Bahrain, there is a regime that since 2011 has been practicing all forms of torment to suppress any political opposition. Fast forward to last week, members of the Bahraini Al-Wifaq Society held a conference in Beirut that documented human rights violations in Bahrain. The conference did not appeal to the Al-Khalifa regime, so the Lebanese government was asked to take the necessary action. It is true that this is not the first time that this type of conference has been held on Lebanese soil, but the Persian Gulf state's insolence reached advanced levels after the incident of Lebanese minister George Qardahi. What was unfamiliar today has become normal on the basis that these tyrannical Arab regimes of the Persian Gulf view Lebanon as their backyard now. Paradoxically, the conference did not bring anything new or strange to the Bahraini regime. It did not come up with anything that human rights symposiums in Lebanon were not familiar with before. Perhaps the strangest thing lies in the Lebanese official reaction, which some have read as presenting credentials to Bahrain and Saudi Arabia behind it. Between Manama's objection and Beirut's response, which seemed more of a royal decree, two questions arise. What does the law say concerning the conference held by the Bahraini Al-Wifaq Society? And how does the law view the reaction of the Lebanese government and its intention to deport Bahraini dissidents? It is crystal clear, my friends. The actions of the Lebanese government towards the Bahraini Al-Wifaq Society are in violation of the Lebanese constitution and internal law, and are in violation of the rules of international custom and the charters of the United Nations, which prompted a lawsuit from a group of Lebanese lawyers who vowed to stop this illegal nonsense instigated by the Ministry of Interior. Yes, we are facing a serious incident in Lebanon that is not only related to the freedom of expression and state sovereignty, but also related to the official Lebanese response, which came as a political compliance to Bahrain's demands, mirroring the groveling of our Lebanese Prime Minister, who desperately wants the approval of Bahrain and Saudi Arabia. However, this is Lebanon, and this is unacceptable. It is forbidden to violate national sovereignty for the sake of saving face before tyrants. That will definitely lead to restriction of the freedom of activists and media professionals simply to please royal dictators who are not even elected in their own countries. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Lebanese Minister of Interior Bassam Maulawi requested in a letter he sent last week to the General Directorate of Public Security that all measures be taken to deport non-Lebanese members of the Bahraini Al-Wifaq Society out of Lebanon. Well, please act surprised, but the Minister of Interior's decision came after a phone call he received from his Bahraini counterpart, Rashid bin Abdullah Al-Khalifa, in which they accused, the Bahraini's Al-Khalifa regime accused the Lebanese party of discussing this press conference held in Beirut as being unacceptable. Now, apparently, the Al-Khalifa regime in Bahrain were insulted by Al-Wifaq's human rights report published in Beirut, accusing Bahrain of arresting thousands of nationals arbitrarily, including hundreds of women and children, issuing hundreds of politicized sentences, and torturing hundreds of detainees. Now, can you see why the Bahraini tyrannical regime felt a bit, exposed? Well, to discuss this issue with us from London is Mr. Adi Al-Faiz, Bahraini human rights activist. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Adi. Now, the Bahraini regime considered the Beirut, or what happened in Beirut, as a press conference held by Al-Wifaq party as totally unacceptable, and is, quote, a flagrant violation of the principles of respect for the sovereignty of states and non-interference in their internal affairs, unquote. Well, I would take that as a joke, but let me ask you that question first. What's your take on this official Bahraini position, and do you think it will really affect the status of the Bahraini opposition group inside of Beirut?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for having me in your show. I believe there are certain points that should be clarified to answer your question. We in the opposition are prohibited from practicing our basic political rights in our homeland, Bahrain. The political leaders and thousands of activists are behind bars, and others are either politically persecuted in Bahrain or in exile. The second point is Al-Wifaq, which represent the majority of Bahrainis, more than 60% of the electoral vote, as per the regime numbers in the 2006 and 2010 election, were for Al-Wifaq. This political party is being resolved by the regime. The current authority, we believe, the current authority lack legal, political, and popular legitimacy. Bahraini regime will never be able to halt our activities nor to crush the opposition. And we believe our colleagues in Al-Wifaq society, the members of Al-Wifaq in Beirut, have worked within the law and exercised their rights in Beirut peacefully.
But Mr. Ali, why did the Bahraini regime feel insulted that Beirut gave a platform for exiled Bahrainis who simply just reported about the fact that Al-Khalifa imprisoned women, they imprisoned children, and they killed detainees for simply having an opinion, but could care less about the official UN reports by international human rights organizations that prove that all was said, all that is was said in Beirut was actually facts. It was not something being told to maybe expose Al-Khalifa, because they were already exposed.
Well, the similar report has been issued by State Department, U.S. State Department, by the Foreign Ministry here in Britain, by the United Nations Human Rights Council, and 9 years or 10 years ago, it was also almost the same issues was represented by Bassuni report. We believe at this point of time, the Al-Khalifa regime understand well that political solution is imminent. There is a pressure to fulfill a human rights obligation in Bahrain, and therefore they have to free the political prisoner and stop the human rights violations in Bahrain. And therefore, the Bahraini regime is utilizing any opportunity to wipe al-Wifaq and the opposition. This is the regime dream, to wipe al-Wifaq and the opposition, because at the time of the political solution, there will be nobody to have dialogue with or represent Bahraini project properly.
But look, it's no secret that all Bahraini activists who are part of the exiled people from Bahrain and others just fled the country to Beirut to find a safe haven for themselves and their families, where it's pretty safe for them in Lebanon, because they have an entire community that actually supports them and is ready to protect them. So since we know that no one really is going to get deported because it's against the law in Lebanon, then why is the Lebanese government putting this show on? For whom is it?
Well, we respect Lebanese, and we respect Lebanon law, and we believe we did not breach the law. We believe it is a political decision taken by the interior minister in Lebanon. And this political decision ordered by the Saudi and the Bahraini regime was a proxy only for this order.
But look, what makes me, as a Lebanese citizen, sure that no Bahraini will be deported, because basically it's against the Lebanese constitution, it's against our law to actually deport people who are taking refuge in Lebanon, who did not even violate our constitution or our law. And because it's a violation of the rules of international custom and the Charter of the United Nations, and Lebanon abides by these laws. So do you think Al-Khalifa might have a certain weapon that they might use to pressure the Lebanese government into probably trying to break their own law?
Well, I think it is Saudi mainly who play the game now. And this game, which is played by the Saudi mainly, is to escape their regional defeat and to fulfill United States and the Zionist goals. They are all, and certainly Bahraini regime, see al-Wifaq and the Bahraini opposition as an enemy for their project in the region, and in particular in Gulf. And that's why we believe taking such decision against al-Wifaq and the opposition is not only for domestic interest, but also for regional interest that related to United States, Zionist, and Saudi.
I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Al-Fayez, Bahraini human rights activist, for joining us to talk about this matter. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about Saudi Arabia's setbacks in Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Well, despite the attempt by the forces loyal to the Saudi-Emirati coalition of aggression following the withdrawal of the militias backed by Abu Dhabi from the areas south of Hudaydah to try and regain the grounds of the western coast and to achieve breakthroughs in oil-rich Ma'rib, the counterattack launched by the Sana'a forces dispersed all these mercenaries. Now, this sparked widespread condemnation among activists who are loyal to the Coalition of Aggression. They accused the latter of betraying its forces. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia is running from one Western power to the other to buy more weapons to try to compensate their successive losses, unable to fathom that they have already completely lost Ma'rib. You see, Ansarullah's control of Ma'rib would not only remodel the balance of power on the ground, but will also put the long-awaited peace processes on the right track. Successive Saudi setbacks in Yemen in this following report.
For almost 7 years now, Saudi Arabia has been floundering in the sands of Yemen. It is not able to resolve the battle militarily in its favor and achieve its declared and hidden goals behind the war, and it has not yet succumbed to the will of the Yemeni people and to the forces that defend it in the face of the defeats and setbacks that it suffers daily. Rather, Saudi Arabia keeps swelling with obstinacy and arrogance. It continues to vent about its failures by trying to harm the Yemeni people through daily massacres and intense air raids. For months, the Yemeni armed forces and the popular committees have been talking about the liberation of Ma'rib. And they continue to make new progress daily without any ability on the part of Saudi Arabia and its allies to stop this progress. In light of what is happening in the entire region, and especially what is happening right now in Ma'rib, with approaching a complete control of the strategic region, and consequently the complete defeat of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and behind it the defeat of the Saudi project before the axis of the resistance in particular, it is just natural to expect an irrational Saudi bash using all available means. This was manifested in a continuation of Saudi arrogance towards anyone who disagrees with it, while Ma'rib city approaches full liberation in favor of the Yemeni army and the popular committees. It can be also seen in the Saudi hysterical pressure for a ceasefire, despite the increase in American armament to Saudi Arabia, which depleted its budget. With a change in the equations of the war, which Saudi Arabia believed needed just weeks to win, Riyadh sought to conclude a large number of arms deals in an attempt to achieve technical and armament superiority, which was already available, but perhaps to compensate for its vast failures. Statements issued by Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Britain, and America keep reining in, stressing the necessity of a ceasefire in Ma'rib, claiming that the quartet countries are committed to, quote, a comprehensive political solution to the conflict in Yemen, unquote, simply because they lost everything on the ground. Meanwhile, fierce battles continue between the Yemeni armed forces of the Sana'a government on the one hand and the forces of Hadi and the Islah party, backed by the planes of Saudi Coalition of Aggression, on the outskirts of the city of Ma'rib. Yemeni armed forces even shot down a U.S. Scan Eagle spy drone while it was carrying out hostile actions in the airspace of Wadi Ubaidah in Ma'rib. Local sources also reported that the Yemeni army and the popular committee secured the sprawling eastern Al-Balaq mountain range, while they continued to advance on the fronts south and east of the city of Ma'rib. The fast successive events in Yemen suggest that the liberation of Ma'rib will no doubt enhance the chances of a lasting strategic peace in Yemen, as it is the last stronghold of Saudi mercenaries in the oil-rich Yemeni governorate.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ali Murad, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us. Ali, now almost 7 years now, the Saudi waged war against Yemen in order to restore what Riyadh calls legitimacy. It seems that the kingdom is experiencing some sort of a crisis related maybe to the futility of its procedures and its inability to come up with a radical solution to probably just shift the course of its aggression against the country. With all such resources, Mr. Ali, with all the state-of-the-art weaponry and war jets that can destroy cities in one round, basically, why did Saudi Arabia lose its war on Yemen?
Greetings to you. The main reason of Saudi Arabia losing its war on Yemen is the ignorance of the Saudi leadership to Yemeni society. Mohammed bin Salman, the current Saudi crown prince, when he began his war in 2015, believed that within 2 weeks he would be able to resolve this war in his favor, because in his belief this would facilitate the process of his ascension to power and being crowned king, and even transferring this so-called victory to other Arab arenas. But his ignorance of the nature of Yemeni society and the circumstances that historically helped Yemenis win their wars and defeat the invaders This specific issue led to Saudi Arabia losing this war despite the presence of a huge arsenal of weapons imported mainly from the United States of America and European countries such as Britain,